In case you haven't caught on by now, we live in a really crazy time, right? I mean, we're asking everybody to be in the center. Yeah, everybody to be in the center so we can hear each other's questions as we go along, okay? When we think about just the changes that have taken place in our world and just some of them within the last 2 or 3 years, and certainly within the last 5 or 10 years, I don't know about you, but to me it's pretty mind-boggling. Things I would never have imagined hearing a significant minority, in some cases even a majority of Americans, saying or thinking or believing. It just really staggers the mind to realize that. I don't know if you can remember back this far, but think back to the last Democratic president before the current one, okay? So we're not going that far back. At the beginning of his presidency, he was opposed to gay marriage. We now live in a culture and a society where not only the president is pro-gay marriage, but almost everybody is. We live in a society now that is having serious thoughts about the whole idea of freedom of speech. We live in a country in where 200 years of American political structure is being questioned and challenged. Right? We live in a world where now it's not just a question of how early can you kill a baby, but now the question is how late can you kill a baby? Can you kill a baby after it's born? Right? We live in a world in which now we're not really sure if men are men and women are women, and I guess you get to decide. These are all things which just a few years ago were incomprehensible to us, right? We would never have imagined that that's where we're going to be. And from all picture of things, the way it looks right now, we're going to keep going in that direction. There's nothing on the horizon that looks like it's going to slow things down, right? So we live in a rapidly changing world, and a world that's changing in ways that many of us, I suspect, are not very comfortable with, right? And actually, that's not the first time that's happened in history. There have been other times in history, of course, when there have been just massive earth-shaking cultural and social changes have taken place. And I think back in my lifetime, another period of time in which that happened was back in the 1960s, and I know I'm dating myself here, but the 1960s was a period of just tremendous upheaval. And for those of us who are old enough to remember those days, we remember a guy by the name of Bob Dylan, right? And Bob Dylan wrote an anthem. Went the wrong way there. New technology here. He wrote an anthem for the changing times. This was about 20 years before he came to Christian faith. But he wrote an anthem called The Times They Are A-Changing, right? And I'm going to try to read this from here because I can't read through those lights up there. But it went, a couple of verses went like this. Come, gather round, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept that it soon will be, you'll be drenched to the bone if your time to you is worth saving, and you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are changing. Come, mothers and fathers throughout the land, and don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend a hand, for the times they are a-changing. And I think that anthem for the changing times of the 1960s applies very much to today, right? The times are changing. Young people are thinking radically different than people of just 10 or 20, young people of even 10 or 20 years ago. And the problem is oftentimes that we really don't know what to do about that. And so one of our obligations, one of our responsibilities as Christians is to understand the times that we live in. So, for example, back in the time when Saul had died and David was going to be king, and there was a great deal of conflict in Israel and in Judah about who was going to be king. And it tells us that the sons of Issachar had an understanding of the times and what Israel should do. They understood the times, and they understood it was time to make David king. Jesus in Luke talks about the people who were able, the crowds that he was talking to, were able to understand the weather. They were able to look at the sky and know what the weather was going to do, but he reprimanded them because they didn't understand the time that they lived in. And when we think about Jesus and we think about Paul, one of the things that you notice about them as you see them interacting with the world around them, talking to people, interacting with people, is they clearly understood how the people they were talking to thought, how the people they were talking to viewed the world they lived in. And one of the reasons that Jesus was so effective and that Paul was so effective is because they understood the view of the world that the people they were talking to had. So that brings up the subject of what we call worldviews. And that's a term you don't hear a lot, particularly in the secular world, and one of the reasons for that is the secular world doesn't think a lot about worldviews. But Christian thinkers over the last 30 or 40 years have done a great deal of thinking about worldviews. So what do we mean when we're talking about a worldview, okay? So a worldview is the lens through which we view, through which we understand all of the reality around us, okay? And it's in part it's an intellectual thing, it's a mental thing, it's how intellectually we understand the world around us, but it's also kind of a spiritual orientation. How am I oriented spiritually so that when I look at the world, I make sense of the world around me, okay? So I'm going to talk about worldviews today. And so this is what I'm talking about. I'm talking about this kind of way that we look at the reality around us and we make sense of the reality around us. Okay? Everything from my relationship with the people in my family to the movement of the cosmos. How do I make sense of all of that? Okay? That's what we're talking about when we're talking about a worldview. Now, it turns out that there are a lot of different worldviews, okay? There are a bunch of them, and I've just listed a few of them up here, okay? So there's one we're most familiar with, probably those of us, all of us here in this room, is what we might call Christian theism or theism, okay? Now, actually, as you'll note there are several different theistic worldviews. There's a Christian theistic worldview. There's the Jewish Christian worldview. There's the Islamic theistic worldview. So a theistic worldview is just a worldview in which the individuals who hold to that worldview believe in a real personal God, okay? And so there are several different theistic worldviews, and we hold to one of those, and that's the Christian worldview. And then there's something called materialism or naturalism. And let me be clear here, when I'm using the term materialism, I'm not using it the way we typically think, okay? So when you're thinking in terms of materialism, what is materialism? Oftentimes you think of, you know, somebody who just likes stuff, right? They like fancy clothes and fancy cars and fancy homes and fancy iPhones, and they're just into buying things and owning things and spending money and that sort of thing. So we talk about people who are materialists in that sense. That's not what we're talking about when we talk about the materialistic worldview. Another term for it that's often you'll often hear is naturalism. Actually, technically speaking, there's a difference between materialism and naturalism, but it's not a difference that we need to go into here. They are, for our practical purposes today, the same thing. There's, of course, Eastern pantheism. So we might think of Hinduism, or we might think of Buddhism or various Eastern religions, okay? And they have a kind of worldview. And then we have, here in the West, we have kind of this strange mixture. James Herricks calls it the new spirituality. Back in my day, we used to call it the New Age movement, okay? But it's kind of a strange mixture of Western thought and Western ideas and Eastern pantheism that kind of mix together into kind of this amalgamated worldview. So, and those are just a few. There are, of course, many, many different worldviews. But here's the catch, okay, is that for most people, they have what we might think of as a composite worldview. So they've kind of done the smorgasbord thing, right? So they have kind of a primary worldview that they use or that they work with, but they've kind of gone around and they've looked at this worldview and they like that, and they've looked at this worldview and they've liked that, and they kind of brought them in together, and they kind of have this composite worldview. So they may be predominantly materialistic, but they may have some Christian thought, or they may be predominantly Christian, but they have some pantheistic thought by which they look at reality and understand reality. And then the other issue that we deal with is that some people have thought a lot about their worldview, and they may not have used that term, but they thought a lot about their system of how they view reality, and they put a lot of effort into it, and they've thought about it. But most people get their worldview by osmosis, okay? They just kind of absorb it. They're in a particular culture, they're in a particular environment, and in that environment that they're in, they just kind of rub shoulders with people, and the way people view things and talk about things and think about it just kind of rubs off on them. And that becomes then their reality. And that presents a challenge for us as Christians, because we tend to do the same thing. So we may have what we think is a Christian worldview, but we may have just through the process of osmosis absorbed some other worldviews into our thinking. And that's one of the things that I want us to think about today and contemplate. So the question is then, well, Rick, why are we doing this? So over this month, each Sunday night this month until Halloween or Fall Festival, we're going to be talking about things related to the credibility of the Christian faith. What Ryan talked about last week is called apologetics, and he was kind of apologetic for the term apologetics, okay? But I like the term apologetics because the term apologetics doesn't mean apology. And the best way I've thought of, in our class on apologetics, the persuasive faith class, I use this illustration. The best way to illustrate the difference between an apology and apologetic is what your child does, okay? When you're there at the house and you hear one of your child screaming bloody murder like he or she's being killed, and you run in the other room and he's screaming at the top of his lungs, and you ask, what's wrong? And he says, well, Susie hit me. Okay, and so you turn to Susie and you begin to quiz her, and then at some point you say, Susie, apologize to your brother. And what does Susie do? Susie doesn't give an apology. She gives an apologetic. She says, he hit me first, right? Okay, so what apologetics is not giving an apology, it's giving a reason, okay? So I like apologetics because apologetics is getting in the habit of being able to give people a reason for the things we do and the things we believe. So the question is, what does worldviews have to do with this whole idea of sharing with people about the credibility of the Christian faith and why we believe the Christian faith? And I would suggest to you that there are several reasons. And the first is our worldview profoundly affects how we think. Okay? So James Sire says in his book, The Universe Next Door, which is a superb book on worldviews, if you're interested in reading one, that's very helpful. He says, everyone has a worldview. Whenever anyone thinks about anything, from a casual thought to a profound question, we are operating in such a framework. Okay, so one of the reasons we need to think about worldviews is because every time we think, we're thinking in this context or framework of our worldview. Okay, it's controlling, it has a controlling influence on how we think. Hold on a second, let me get caught up here on my notes. So, another reason that we need to talk about worldviews is because if we're really going to effectively relate to other people, we need to have an understanding of how they view the world. That's why I mentioned Jesus and Paul. One of the reasons they were effective is because they were able to understand how other people thought. So, and then another reason is, as I mentioned, we tend to absorb perspectives and ideas from other worldviews and that sort of thing. And we need to be able to identify those. So sometimes I think, you know, well, no, I'm not a pantheist, but, you know, then I realize I'm thinking a certain way. And I go, you know, that sure sounds kind of pantheistic. Have I absorbed something there that I didn't intend to absorb? And then another thing is we need to understand worldviews if we're going to be effective in relating to other people and talking to other people about the faith and that sort of thing. And I like this quote that comes from a famous theologian of the last century, early part of the 20th century, a guy by the name of J. Gresham Machen. And he was speaking at the opening session of Princeton Seminary in 1912, which tells you a lot about how far we've come to realize that in 1912, one of the leading speakers at Princeton Seminary's opening ceremonies was J. Gresham Machen. But he says, false ideas are the greatest obstacle to the reception of the gospel. We may preach with all the fervor of a reformer and yet succeed only in winning a straggler here and there if we permit the whole objective thought of the nation to be controlled by ideas which prevent Christianity from being regarded as anything more than a harmless delusion. And I think he really nails it, and we've certainly seen over the last 100 years, we've seen that happen in America. We've seen American society and American culture progressively adopt ideas and thoughts that make it more and more difficult to share the gospel. It's more difficult today, or certainly we have to approach it completely different, the sharing of the gospel, than we did 50 years ago. We live in a different world. The times, they are changing. But tonight, I just want to talk about a couple things in particular, a couple worldviews in particular. One is I want to talk about our own worldview and Christian theism, and I want to talk then about what is probably the major competing worldview in our culture and in our society today, which is this one of materialism and naturalism. So I want to think those through. So first of all, just kind of to briefly review, since most of us are probably familiar with Christian theism, to kind of briefly review what are some of the key points of Christian theism. Now, there's much more than I'm going to list here, but I want to list four, five, six key points of Christian theism at which they differ from materialism and naturalism. Okay? So the first one is, in Christian theism, of course, ultimate reality. Sire, in his analysis of worldviews, likes to talk about what is the ultimate reality in a given worldview. Okay, and the ultimate reality, meaning that reality which is the explanation of all other realities. Okay, So what is the root reality that's the explanation of everything else that's real? And in Christian theism, that root reality, that ultimate reality, is God. And in Christian theism, we have a couple aspects about God. One is that he exists, okay? That's an important thing to us. And then the second thing is his nature. There are certain things about the nature of God. Now, I've done a study in which I've tried to figure out as many different things about the nature of God and the character of God, and I've come up with like between 50 and 60 different elements or parts of the aspects of the nature of God and that sort of thing. But there are a bunch of them, but the point I'm trying to make is that Christianity has a view of a real personal God who exists, who is both transcendent. He transcends the world and he transcends space, he transcends time and all that sort of thing, but he's also immanent. He's present in the world, he's present in time, he's active in the world, that sort of thing. Those are characteristics of a theistic worldview, and in Christianity we have a pretty clear picture of what that God is like. And then another key element of the theistic worldview is the doctrine of creation. It's very difficult to overemphasize how important this idea is, the doctrine of creation. And when I'm talking about the doctrine of creation, I'm not just talking about the evolution creation debate, okay? That's part of it, but that's only a small part of it, or only a part of it anyway. It's just that whole idea of creation. Where did the cosmos come from? Okay, and in addition to kind of where did it come from, of course, is the idea of who was the originator of it. And of course, in Christian theism, God is the origin of it. But in addition to that, one of the things that's central to the idea of the Christian idea of creation is that creation has an order to it. It's very difficult to overemphasize how important that idea of order is, and the idea associated with that, the idea of purpose, okay? That creation has a purpose. And this is a central element of Christian theology, is that creation comes from God and has order and purpose in it. And we have a fancy word for that that we use when we talk about the purpose in creation. It's called teleology, okay? So there's a teleology has to do, or theological has to do with the idea of something having a purpose or an end or a goal in mind, okay? Our OU football team is having a little bit of problem accomplishing their teleology lately, right? That goal of scoring touchdowns, right? Yesterday was a little better. Hopefully it'll get better down the road, okay? So there's a goal, there's a purpose, there's a teleology, okay? And that exists within creation, and that's central to our ideas. And then is the issue of the nature of humanness. What are human beings? And again, central to that, very difficult to overemphasize, is the concept of the Imago Dei, that mankind is created, he's created by God, and he bears in some way or in some sense the image of God, okay? And also is the idea of what's called dualism, or a fancier word for it is called substance dualism. And what we mean by that is that human beings are not just physical bodies. Okay, we are physical bodies, and our physical bodies are a very important part of what we are, but we also have a non-material aspect to us. That's what we mean by dualists. There's kind of two parts to us. There's our physical part, and there's our non-material part. Now, Christians differ on exactly the nature of that non-material part. Is it just spirit, or is it spirit and soul? You know, there's questions or debates about that among Christians, but the essential thing is that we have a non-material aspect to our being. And then is the whole place or role of reason, okay? So in Christian theism, God is the source of reason. He is reasonable. He has given us the capacity to reason. Reason is important. But there is something that's more important than reason, and that's revelation, what God says. Okay, it's something that we get from God that we can't get through reason. I can't reason my way to the doctrine of the atonement. I can only I can only know about the atonement through revelation as God tells me about Christ dying for my sins, okay? And then another key aspect is the source of morality and ethics. So within Christian theism, the source of morality and ethics is God. So we say it's objective. It's outside of us, okay? But then we have the rise in Western civilization, and particularly here, I'm thinking here in America, but we have to think about Western civilization in general. We have the rise of materialism, and we don't have time today. I'm going to go through this very quickly because we don't have time to talk about it, but the rise of materialism has been a long, ongoing thing. It didn't happen last night. It didn't happen last year. It didn't happen in the 20th century. Okay, it's been going for a long time, and actually it starts clear back with the early Greeks. But then you get a number of developments in Western civilization beginning in about the 14th century, a series of things which had an influence on the development of materialism. Now, not all these things were materialistic in their nature, but they had an effect that fed into the growth of materialism in our culture and society. And the first one that I mention is the Renaissance, the Reformation, which of course is Protestants. We're very positive, and we think very positive about the Reformation. But the Reformation also played a role in the growth of materialism. The Enlightenment of the 17th and 18th centuries had a profound influence on the way Westerners think about reality and began to really shape this whole idea of the materialist or naturalistic worldview. Then following the Enlightenment, you have the period for about 50 to 70 years of Romanticism. And then you get three guys who are particularly influential, and that's Darwin, Marx, and Nietzsche. Okay. And what Darwin did is he provided the story for materialism. So until you had Darwin, materialists had a materialistic view of the world, but they couldn't explain how it happened. What Darwin did is he gave them a story. We have a story about how things happen. We have the Bible. We have the story of the Bible. Now they have the story of evolution. But the other thing that Darwin did is he brought an end to the idea of teleology. If the universe that we live in just happened by accident, there's no purpose to it, okay? So we've now had the termination of teleology. So in materialism, you'll encounter that. Then you have Marx, and with Marx, his whole idea was the malleability of human nature. So human nature could be changed. We can manipulate human nature and change it at will. In particular, of course, he was focused on the economic aspect of that. And what Nietzsche did is Carl Truman, who's the author of The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, points out that what Nietzsche did is he called the bluff on the Enlightenment. So what the Enlightenment did is it jettisoned a whole lot of our Christian beliefs, but it wanted to maintain the benefits of Christianity. And what Nietzsche said was, you can't do that, okay? If we're going to jettison God, if God is dead, as he talks about, in the sense that we no longer believe in God, then we need to start living like God is dead, all right? And so he asked the question, who wiped out the horizon? He has this picture, image of a guy with a sponge wiping out the horizon. The idea of the horizon is our point of reference by which we orient ourselves. And what he's saying is we no longer have Christian theism by which we can orient ourselves. We can no longer think that way. Okay. So these were just some of the key elements in the rise of naturalism, which has become for us today one of the primary ways that Westerners think about reality. And certainly the people you rub shoulders with, many of your teachers in school, your friends, your neighbors, your children or your parents, think in this way in one way or another. So we thought about the key elements of theism. How does naturalism compare to that? So when we think about it, With naturalism, ultimate reality, with theism, it was God. With materialism or naturalism, ultimate reality is matter. Okay? It's just stuff. Okay? And by stuff, I don't mean chairs and pianos and fancy gadgets. I mean molecules and atoms and neutrons and things like that. That's ultimate reality. So what I'm saying is that in materialism, all reality comes from matter. Okay? So if that's true, then matter needs to be eternal. Okay? It has to have existed eternally. And for many centuries, many materialists did think that matter was eternal. But then in the last 100 years or so, they've run up smack against scientific discoveries primarily related to Big Bang cosmology. And in Big Bang cosmology, they discovered that the universe is expanding, and if they extrapolate backwards, that means the universe had a beginning. So for most of the 20th century, materialists really struggled with trying to figure out some other way to explain the expansion of the universe without accepting the idea of a beginning. I don't have time to go into all of that right now. But matter is all that exists. So Carl Sagan, you're probably familiar with Carl Sagan, famous American astronomer. He said, "The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be." So there's nothing non-material. Everything is matter. Okay? And then the cosmos, the universe, is a closed system. And what we mean by that is there's nothing outside of the universe acting upon it or that can act upon it, because matter is everything and matter is ultimate reality. So there's no reality beyond the universe acting on the universe. In other words, there's no God out there, folks. There's no God affecting how the universe can function or working in the universe. And then there's the materialist understanding of human nature. In materialist view of human nature, they have a view called physicalism. And by physicalism, they simply mean, that's all you are, folks. You're just your body. You don't have any non-material aspect to you, okay? So when you think, when you have thoughts, the only thing that's happening is there's just these electromagnetic impulses going on in your brain. There's no spirit, there's no soul, there's nothing in there in you that's thinking. It's just these random acts going on in your brain that cause you, for whatever reason, I was going to say God only knows, but for materialists, God doesn't even know why you think the way you do, okay? And then there's the question of human reason. So if matter is all there is, and if everything is just kind of an accident, then what is the source of knowledge? Where do we get knowledge? And they're kind of all over the map on this. One way you get knowledge is through rationalism, and rationalism is the idea that all knowledge just comes through reasoning. The only way you can get knowledge is by reasoning to it from things you already know. Okay, and that is called rationalism. It has origins going back into the Enlightenment and to René Descartes and his "I think, therefore I am" thing. And then for some, it's empiricism. So the only way we can know things is by the physical senses, by our five senses. So I can only know reality by what I can touch or feel or whatever. So basically, this is what we call scientism, that the only knowledge we can have is the knowledge that science provides for us. Our only access to knowledge is through science. Okay, and then there's the whole question of consciousness, just the fact that you're conscious and the fact that you can think. Okay, where does that come from? And in Christian theism, that's an ability that is given to us by God. God has given to us consciousness, and he's given to us cognition. I would argue that those are aspects of the Imago Dei. But in materialism, they've got to figure out some way of explaining consciousness and explaining cognition, the ability to think. And they do that in several ways. And again, I don't have time to go into all of that. But they have various ways they explain that. But one is they talk about cognition and consciousness just being something that just kind of is secreted from our physical being somehow. They can't explain what that means, but it's what they call this epiphenomena that just kind of grows out of matter. Of course, we've never seen it grow out of a rock or a tree or whatever, but that's their explanation. And then there's the whole question of ethics and morality. And again, here they're really groping for some kind of coherent and believable explanation for the origin of ethics and morality, because almost all materialists, not all materialists, but almost all materialists believe that there are certain moral obligations that we have as people, that there are certain ethical standards, all right? And for many of them, that's arrived at pragmatically. So the question is simply, what works? So, and how they define what works, they define it in different ways. Some is, you know, what helps the survival of the species. So, you know, I treat my neighbor nice and I don't steal his bicycle because somehow that's beneficial to the survival of the species. For many, the whole idea of ethics and morality is that it's evolving, just like everything else in their view is evolving and changing. But what's key is to understand that morality originates from matter. Okay, so it doesn't come from outside, doesn't come from God. It just somehow is emitted from matter. It comes from matter in some way. We might call that moral scientism. And then for some, morals and ethics, that sort of thing, is just an illusion. There is no such thing as morals or ethics. Okay, we just kind of made it up, folks. It's a social construct. So the question that I want to, the issue I want to address in the time we have left is, how does the materialistic worldview, how does it influence the way we think and the way we act and that sort of thing? And there are several ways that it does that are very profound. And one is, it changes the way we think about the self. What is the self? What is my identity? Okay? So all of this stuff that's happening now with all these ideas of gender, and that there's all these many different ways, many different kinds of gender, and you can be a man or you can be a woman or you can be an it or you can be a whatever, okay? That seems very bizarre to us who think in a Christian theistic worldview, right? But in reality, it makes sense from a materialistic perspective, all right? And the reason is because their identity has been cut off from the Creator, okay? They don't have a Creator that's created them in a certain way, in a certain order, with a certain purpose, right? And once we've separated, once we've cut people off from the idea that they are created, then they've got to figure out what they are. And that leads to psychologizing of the self, okay? That the self is determined by what I, in my own inner being, feel like I am. So it's no, I'm no longer what God says I am. I am what I figure out I am, what feels good to me, or what makes sense to me. Okay, it's some people refer to it as kind of the therapeutic person. All right, and what this means then is, if I am what I think I am or feel I am, this kind of psychological self, if that's the me, if that's the self, then if anybody contradicts that and says to me, well, no, you're not a woman, you are a man, okay? Or you're not of this, you are that. If somebody says to that, they're oppressing me. I am being oppressed. Now, that may sound silly to us coming from a different worldview, but it makes perfect sense in this worldview. In the materialistic worldview, everybody gets to decide what they are, and anybody who contradicts that is oppressing them. Okay? And so that's where we get this whole idea that you've got to call somebody by whatever pronoun they say you've got to call them by. Because if you don't, you're denying their identity. You're denying their reality of what they are. All right? And then the thing that we have to realize is that all the major institutions from culture on down, all right, all the major institutions throughout Western history, in fact, throughout human history, have been designed to help shape people into what they ought to be within the context of the community or within the context of the culture. So the purpose of culture, one of the purposes of culture, is to shape people into what they ought to be because they have a purpose. But if you don't have a purpose, and if you get to decide what you are, then all of these institutions have become repressive. So our educational institutions, our churches, our culture, our history, all of that is repressive because it's trying to impose upon me an identity that I don't think is me. Okay? So this explains then why we are encountering some of the things we're encountering in our culture and in our society today. I kind of sped ahead there and talked about the idea of culture and the idea of history. So there is within this materialistic worldview now, there is developing this kind of mentality of anti-historicism and anti-culture. Okay, so that's why we see people tearing down statues and trying to erase the memory of people in the history, because those represent a repression of my personal identity. Okay? And then on the issue of the understanding of morality, we no longer have an objective source of morality, all right? So then the question is, what are my options? Well, one is, well, maybe science somehow can provide me with an objective source. And there's been about 150 years of scientific research trying to find a scientific source for morality, and the conclusion that most of the scientists working in that field have reached is there is no such thing as morality. And then, of course, that's where we get moral relativism. If my identity is totally within myself, if I'm cut off from any kind of objective morality, I don't have any choice. Right? I'm forced into moral relativism. So it's not just some kind of arbitrary position a person takes, it's a product of the worldview that they live by. Then the whole idea of human significance. We have, of course, the loss of significance because we're just an accident. We're just a product of atoms and molecules smashing together and that sort of thing. So we have a loss of significance, so then humans become animals. Okay. That's all we are. We're just animals. And so we end up then with the modern environmental movement. Now, of course, when you read the Bible, you understand that there's a Christian mandate to care for creation, okay? There is a mandate to do that, and God cares a great deal about the environment, and he cares how we treat our animals and that sort of thing. But that's a far cry from the modern environmental movement, which has elevated nature at least to the level of man and the significance of man, and in some cases above man. Okay, that's all a product of the worldview. It's where we get abortion, we get euthanasia because of the loss of human significance. And it's where we get population control. God said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And now we have the whole population control movement that's trying to counter the command of God, and some aspects of artificial intelligence and developments in the area of artificial are all a product of this loss of significance. Now, what I want to point out, and then I want to stop, is that worldview is out there, and if we compare the theistic worldview, the one we say we believe, and the materialistic worldview, we can see some very significant differences, right? But the fact is, this is the air we breathe, folks. This is what we live in. We see it on television. We see it on our computers. We hear it from our neighbors. We get it from our friends. It's all around us. It is the dominant worldview. Christianity in America is not the dominant worldview anymore. Materialism is, along with some of these other worldviews, come into play. Okay, so it's the air we breathe. The old medieval Saint Peter Abelard talked about the three sources of temptation for us: the world, the flesh, and the devil. And one of the things that strikes me when I think about that is, I can see the materialistic worldview pulling at me in all three of these areas. Right, I can see just the world around me, as we've talked about, is pulling me in this direction. I want to fit in with the world. I want to be accepted in the world and that sort of thing. My flesh finds certain aspects of the materialistic worldview attractive. And, of course, the devil is out to deceive me and to get me to buy into this worldview. So the question is, are we closet materialists? And this is one of the things that I wrestle with more and more in my life, as I keep asking myself, how much of the world's worldview have I absorbed? And part of what being a Christian and trying to grow in Christ and become a mature Christian is, part of that process is learning to figure out where I have absorbed the world's worldview and learning to put that aside and adopt a truly biblical Christian worldview. Okay, so in the time we have left, let's take just 5 minutes. Does anybody have any questions? I know I've gone through stuff I take in apologetics class. We take several weeks to cover. I've just gone over in about 45 minutes. But, so anybody have any questions that come up, anything popped in your mind? You know, when you ask for questions and you don't get any, that says two things, one of two things. It says either people didn't understand a thing you said, or else you did such a perfect job there are no questions left. And I'm hoping that it's not either. Yes? Would I talk about that? Yeah, I think that all of these things we talked about how the materialist thinks. Oh, excuse me. Her question was, she wanted me to elaborate on that quote from J. Gresham Machen about false ideas being an obstacle to the gospel. And I think that almost every aspect of that. So, for example, if the materialist says there is no God, that's obviously an obstacle to the gospel, right? So if one of the dominant concepts in our culture is there is no God or he's not active in the world, which is deism, if that's the way they think, then if I start talking to them about the Christian message, it's just going to go right over their head, right? So one of the things I have to deal with is I have to deal with that question, is there a God? And I have to have reasons to give them and explain them. And this goes on down the line. So if they're caught up in this whole identity thing, then I need to help them understand that God had a purpose for their life. They've missed that purpose. They need a redeemer, right? But as long as they're hung up on this idea that there is no purpose for their life, that's going to be an obstacle to God. So almost in every area that we've looked at, that would be an obstacle that we as a Christian apologist need to be able to address. Anybody else? Yeah. No, not necessarily. Another point before I address that, though, is there are a bunch of worldviews. So there are more worldviews at play than just materialism, which is one of the reasons why when we talk to people, one of the first things we need to find out is where are they coming from. So we really need to listen to people. We need to ask them questions, figure out where they're coming from. But there are many different ways to approach people. But oftentimes, yes, you're going to have to go back. You're going to have to go back to, you know, and you're going to have some people who are materialist Christians, you know. So they may believe in a God, but they've bought into a bunch of materialism. So you might not have to go all the way back to the existence of God. But to the atheist, yes, that's where you're going to have to start. You're going to have to start with the existence of God, okay? And, of course, there are tremendous arguments for that. So I would say no, you don't always have to go all the way back to the beginning. What you have to do is figure out where are they and where is the glitch. And then you have to figure out how to address that glitch. That I think that's how I would answer that question. Anybody else real quickly? And we need to make room for Ronnie up here. I'll get shot. So any other questions? Okay, thank you. See y'all. Cut me off. Next week, we're going to talk about the Bible and why we believe the Bible is the Word of God and why we believe the Bible is true. So the credibility of the Scriptures next week.